We've seen that Saul has become both exceedingly frightened and jealous of David. This has led to outbursts of anger against David with a spear. At one point, twice, trying to kill him, and yet David stayed there after the first one. I'd be running after the first time he tried to do it, but he stayed. Loyalty of this man and trust in God. Obviously, the Holy Spirit was in him as well, empowering him. And all of this frightened attitude, this jealousy has led to these outbursts of anger, as well as more subtle attempts by Saul to murder him by placing him in military positions where he would be, he felt, very easily killed. And in human terms, of course, you know, you throw him into the battle, he's inexperienced, he's going to die. And so this was Saul's attitude. I want him to die. So, you know, it wasn't just outbursts. You know, sometimes we have angry outbursts and, okay, Saul just has a bad temper. No, this guy's plotting against him. So we see it, not only are there angry outbursts, but there are plots here being schemed against David. And at the end of chapter 18, we saw that David not only survived the difficult situations into which Saul placed him, but he excelled heroically in those situations. At the end of verse 27 of the last chapter, Saul has no choice but to allow a situation with which he no doubt was extremely uncomfortable. And that is, David would become his son-in-law and a man in line for the throne. He didn't want to see this. He wanted to avoid this. So, you know, you can have my daughter. No, you can't have my daughter. She loves you. You can have her. But first, you know, you've got to go to battle and you've got to bring me, you know, the foreskins of this many Philistines. And I mean, just all kinds of requirements. Hopefully David would die through all of this, but he didn't. He excelled. And we see, and we've seen over and over again, that God, that man is immortal until God calls him home. David found that to be true. Paul found that to be true. Man is immortal. A Christian is immortal until it's God, and it's God's choice. He's sovereign until God calls us home. You know, that's great comfort when we serve God. Sometimes we think, well, maybe I'll die early. No, you won't die a day early than what God has intended for you. Obviously, we can, you know, we can mess up, and you know, the discipline of God can in that sense cut our life short. Obviously, God knows the end from the beginning and all of that. I understand that. He's still sovereign regardless. We don't short-circuit his sovereignty by our disobedience. But at the same time, it is true that, you know, as a Christian, our lives can be shortened if we live a sinful life and we decide, I'm going to do my own thing. But anyhow, but again, we understand if I'm serving the Lord, I don't sit there and need to fret and, you know, wring my hands. People say, you know, you go to the Middle East. Isn't that scary going to the Middle East? It has been sometimes, yeah. There have been times. But understand that my life is not going to end one day shorter than what God intends it to. And the fact is that I am just as close to eternity in the United States as I am overseas. Just as close. One step to eternity. And I can die just as much. Haven't you heard stories of people that went to war, they went to battle, and they survived these situations? Then they came home and were struck by a car out on the road and died? I mean, you know, that's happened more than once. I've heard that story again and again from different angles, different people. And, you know, he survived all of these attacks and then came home and died like that, you know. You know what? When it's your time, when God has intended for you to come home, you'll come home, but not a day sooner. And we see it here in the life of David. He survived these difficult situations. And again, not only that, he excelled heroically. And so here Saul allows this marriage. He has no choice. David would become his son-in-law. He would become a man in line to the throne. And so Saul gave his daughter Michal as a wife to David. And again, he gave him one last requirement that he hoped would kill him. And that is, he had to kill 100 Philistines instead of a dowry. The only dowry I want, 100 Philistines, 100 of my enemies. He hoped that would bring the king's future son-in-law death. And the fact that he was going to become the king's son-in-law might make him more vulnerable to Philistine attack, and he'd definitely die in battle. But every time Saul sought to destroy David, the Lord in his sovereignty made him, again, not only survive but thrive. And as we conclude our review, look at verses 28 through 30 of chapter 18. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Didn't get any better. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. Well, now it's bad. There's no pleasantry here from Saul to David. We're enemies. Verse 30, then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul. So his name was highly esteemed, and now they're respecting him. Surely that bothered Saul too. And so now we see the murder plot against David, a crazed king and a faithful friend. We see both of these things. But notice, first of all, in verses 1 through 3, which we'll read in a moment, we see the murder plot and the loyalty of a faithful friend. Verses 1 through 3, now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all the servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now, therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I find out anything, then I will tell you. So here in verses 1 and 2, notice first of all it says, now Saul told Jonathan his son and all his servants to put David to death. So Saul's grown desperate. Absolute desperation. There's no subterfuge. That's over with. There's no more deceit. There's no more, compliment him so he'll do this. It's not subtle at all anymore. He's not trying to hide it from anyone. I want him dead. He's desperate. And so he even lets his own son know and the people of his administration know that he wants David dead, and he wants them to do it as soon as possible. So gloves off here. He's going after him now full bore. And notice it says, though, about Jonathan that he greatly delighted in David. This is the identical expression used in chapter 18 and verse 22. Notice chapter 18, verse 22, and who it's in reference to. Then Saul commanded his servants, speak to David secretly, saying, behold, the king delights in you. So, of course, that wasn't true. That was to butter him up a little bit, get him to marry his daughter, agree to marry his daughter. But notice what it says about Jonathan. It was true of him. Jonathan greatly delighted in David. Jonathan, as David's covenanted friend, was indeed a true friend. And here, Jonathan shows both loyalty to his friend as well as respect to his father and king both. He shows himself here to be a noble and wise man. Now, we can learn things from Jonathan. He has a tremendous testimony. You know, it shows you something, and that is relatives, or I should say children, are not always doomed to be like their folks. You know, maybe you grew up in a really rotten home, and you say, well, I'm kind of doomed. I'm going to be like my mom. I'm going to be like my dad, or whatever, you know. And there's nothing I can do about it. Oh, yeah, there is. You are an individual. You have a choice to make. And Jonathan had a choice to make, and he made the right choice. He was very much unlike his father. His father was selfish. His father, again, only cared about himself, only cared about self-preservation. And yet Jonathan here is concerned about his friend. He's concerned about the glory of God, not himself. And so, no, a child is not doomed to be like his or her parent. That's not the case. We are individuals. We make individual decisions. And by the way, that sometimes is true. You know, you may raise a child and that child may go wrong. That may or may not be your fault. Sometimes it is, I guess. But children have their own will. They do their own thing. We can't always, as they become an adult or they get out of the home, that sort of thing, they're not under their parents' authority anymore. We wish they would be, but sometimes they're not. So you're not doomed to be like your folks, all right? Stand up for God yourself. And here we have a great example of someone who was very much unlike his dad. You know, Jonathan, too, shows himself wise. Wise with his dad, wise with King David. Great wisdom here in this situation. You know, some believers don't show themselves very wise in situations like this. You know, Daniel was another man who uncompromisingly stood up for what was right, but he still did it with wisdom and respect. We need to do the same thing. We need to have wisdom and respect when we stand up for what's right. We shouldn't say, I'm going to get down in the mud, and I'm going to fight evil with evil. You're going to fight dirty, I'm going to fight dirty too. That's not the way Christians should be. Also in this passage, we once again see that the plans of a sovereign God can't be thwarted. David, again, as I mentioned a moment ago, would not die one moment sooner than God had planned for him. Also, God would fulfill his will through David. And later, God made a covenant with David that stated in essence that through his line, Messiah would come. God will accomplish his will in the world no matter what man may try to do. No matter what Satan may try to do, God will still accomplish his will in the world in which we live. Now, some doubt whether openly or even inwardly, that Christ is ever going to come in the air for his saints. You know, like, well, you know, 2,000 years, been a long time. I don't think Christ is going to come. I think that's a foolish teaching. That's just hopefulness from Christians. And some people doubt that. How foolish. Others may doubt that God will fulfill some other promise of his word. Well, he's overdoing it with me. God said that he wouldn't give me more than I could handle, but he is. No, he didn't lie to you. He doesn't give us more than we can handle. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation make a way to escape, a way of escape that you might be able to bear up under it. Now notice, we read way of escape, that means he's going to take us out of the situation every time. That isn't what the text says. A way of escape that what? You might be able to bear up. You might be able to bear up under it. That's the way of escape. He gives us strength that we might be able to handle what we have. So you say, I got too much on my plate. God is, God's not being faithful to his promise. He's always faithful to his promises. And God will accomplish what he wills and what he's promised no matter what. But sometimes we forget he's omnipotent. Psalm 2. Sometimes we forget he's in control. But anyhow, here Jonathan says to David, please be on your guard in the morning. So apparently it was evening when Saul gave the command to his men to kill David in the morning. We see that at this point, that Jonathan quickly rushed to David's side to let him know that he needed to watch his back and he needed to hide out the next morning because daddy's going to be after you and you know, the administration is going to be after you. And these circumstances would become very familiar to David for a long period of time. Throughout his life, David would be a hunted fugitive. Think about that. God has anointed you as king, and he becomes a hunted fugitive until the end of Saul. So, Jonathan, be on your guard, you know. God's servants always have to be on guard, because if we don't, the enemy is still on guard. The enemy is still after us all the time. So we always have to be on guard. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, the Bible says, Satan as a roaring lion seeks whom he may devour. A roaring lion, one that's hungry, doesn't stop. He doesn't pause. He doesn't say, well, I'll give you a moment to catch your breath so you can fight back a little bit. That's not what a roaring lion does. When he's hungry, he eats you. He destroys you. Satan is the same way. It's not like he's going to do something good for you. He's going to reward you somehow. Well, there might be some seeming reward but from doing what's wrong, but no, he's a roaring lion, and he seeks whom he may devour. He wants to devour you and me. Be on guard. So like Saul, Satan is the same way, and we need to be on guard. Verse 3. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I find out anything, then I'll tell you. So Jonathan's going to be an advocate for David with his father, Saul, and meet with his father in the same field where David is going to be hiding out. So he'll be a distance away. Jonathan would then be able to quickly relate to David what he's learned. And then notice, number two, we find in verses 4-7, the intercession of the faithful friend and the temporary truce. Now, this is temporary, all right? There is a temporary truce, but remember what we saw in the last chapter. It's going to be David's enemy constantly now. That's very short-lived. But notice verses 4-7, beginning in verse 4. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you. And since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. Verse 5. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, talking about Goliath, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Well, yeah. We'll see. Verse 7, then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in the presence as formerly, but a very short time. Notice, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he's not sinned against you. You have to admire the boldness of Jonathan. He respects his dad, but he's telling it the way it is. He's not sinned against you. Why would you want to sin against him, Dad? It doesn't make sense. And as we've said before, it's easy to see why these two bold men of faith, David and Jonathan, were friends. They were men of the same character. They were willing to stand up and do what's right even when others were not doing it. Jonathan was willing to stand up against his own father, the king of Israel, and say, but this is sinful behavior. This is wrong. Why would you do this against David? He's only done beneficial things to you. His deeds have been very beneficial to you, for he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. And you saw it and rejoiced. Here, Jonathan uses logic to persuade King Saul for the moment, and he does for the moment. He argues that David has only benefited you. He's never harmed you in any way. David has only been a loyal subject who has benefited you. Jonathan then concludes by asking his father this question: why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? Later, Jonathan would have to ask the same question again, chapter 20, verse 32. Same question. Good question. And one we never hear an answer to. No doubt David was being persecuted unfairly. You ever find yourself in a similar situation where you're being persecuted unfairly? Maybe it was at work. You know? Maybe it was among your family members. And you thought, I've done nothing wrong. Why are they doing this? And, you know, I find sometimes Christians even back up and they feel kind of guilty. Well, maybe I have done so. You know, maybe we have a chance sometimes to kind of question ourselves. And that's not all bad, but sometimes we overdo it and we feel guilty for no reason at all. You've been living for the Lord. You've done what you can. You've been kind. You've been respectful. Now, if you haven't been, then maybe you deserve some of that. But you've been kind. You've been respectful. You go back through your motives and that sort of thing, and you say, I've done everything I can. Don't feel guilty if that's the case. If you're standing up for what's right and doing the right thing, having the right attitude, there's no reason to feel guilty. You just need to trust the Lord with the situation. But often, you know, we are persecuted unfairly. Sometimes at work, Christians may even lose their jobs sometimes. They might have things made up about them just to get rid of them because people are uncomfortable with believers. We make them feel guilty. And family members, same thing. We make them feel guilty. Well, you're condemning me. Well, I'm not condemning anybody. Maybe you share the gospel with, I'm a sinner. Oh, you think I'm a real bad person. You're missing the point. We're all bad people. But people are always going to misunderstand us. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 4 for a moment, will you? 1 Peter chapter 4. We will be back. 1 Peter chapter 4. And here Peter is talking to those who are persecuted, Christians being persecuted. 1 Peter chapter 4. Verses 12 through 16. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. When Jesus comes in the air for his saints, you can rejoice with exultation because you've done what's right. Don't be thrown off. Don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal. Notice, continuing on. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. So if you suffer for a crime, or if you suffer for cussing somebody out, or if you suffer for, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, you deserve it. All right? But if you suffer as a Christian, there's no reason to be ashamed. If you've done everything you can to do the right thing, and you stand up as a believer, and maybe you take a position, have to do that, don't be ashamed. But glorify God in this name. Don't be ashamed of standing up and doing right and suffering for it. I remember some years ago, my mom and I worked for a telemarketing agency. And it was one of the summer jobs you have in college. And my mom and I went into work, and they said, okay, you're going to be, and it was At the time, it was, we were to call carpet outlets and ask them about the carpet Ansel IV. I still remember what the carpet was. Do you like it? We'd ask them questions. And they said, you have to tell them you're calling from Chicago, Illinois, and not Detroit, Michigan, because if you say Detroit, Michigan, it's going to kind of give away who we are and that sort of thing. So just say you're from Chicago, Illinois. It's interesting. I remember sitting there and hearing a guy behind me. Obviously, they asked him, what's the weather in Chicago like? Oh, it's fine. And he went right on. But anyhow, my mom and I went up to the boss and I said, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to do that. I said, I'm not going to lie about it. We're not in Chicago, we're in Detroit. And I'm not going to tell, you know. So what they did, they ended up giving a subsidiary name where it would not be as obvious who we were. And that was fine. It was still the same company. It was a subsidiary name of that company. We didn't say we're from Chicago, Illinois, or anything like that. And we said exactly who we were and where we're from. Well, sometimes it works out well when you stand up for what's right. Sometimes it doesn't. But let me tell you, don't deceive. It's wrong to lie. We saw Saul as a liar. We see him again as a liar. I take an oath. I'm not going to. That didn't last long. That didn't last long. He hated David. Continually, Scripture said. And don't be ashamed when, you know, if we had to go home and not have a job, that's God's will. That's okay. Then that's what God has for you. But don't do what's wrong. Stand up for what's right. And we have a sovereign God who's in control. And it was obvious that day that God was in control. I didn't know when I went up to the boss that both of us weren't going to be fired. But I knew that I couldn't lie. It was wrong. And so, same has to be true for each one of us. Notice verse 6. Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, albeit temporarily, and Saul vowed, again, he's not a truthful man, as the Lord lives. Wow. He's invoking the name of Yahweh. Capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. That is God's personal name to Israel. Yahweh. As Yahweh lives, he shall not be put to death. Woo. He takes an oath that he's soon going to break. Amazing. Verse 7. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. Although dismissed from his position in the court, David now returns to serve, at least in part, as Saul's harpist. So temporarily, he's back in the court again under the protection of the king, but that's not going to last very long. And so we see number 3, verses 8 through 10, the renewed conflict and the narrow escape. The renewed conflict and the narrow escape. Verse 8. When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter, so that they fled before him. Again, God bringing great victory. Verse 9. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul, as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. So here again, same kind of a situation. He's got his spear. Evil spirit comes upon him. This is God's judgment on this man, Saul. And in verse 10, but yet God still protects David in this. Verse 10, Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence. This time he doesn't stay around for another round. He's gone. I don't blame him. So that he struck that spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. So verse 8, apparently David also continued with his military duties too. Okay, this may have not been a plot at this time. It just may be that, you know, David's successful, and so he's going to continue doing that responsibility too. So that may not be part of the plot per se at this time, but just something that David has a responsibility. Now he's got another one again in Saul's court. Again, very temporary. So he's just continuing a task at which he's been successful. So David continues again to show that God is with him in everything that he does. Verses 9 and 10, we see a repeat of the past. We just mentioned that a moment ago. An evil spirit. And here's Saul sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. David's there playing the harp, calming him down. And he takes that spear and he tries to pin David to the wall with the spear. But here David slips out of Saul's presence so that he strikes the spear into the wall. It sticks into the wall and David ran away and he flees into the night. Saul was under the influence of a demon. But I want you to notice something, that God was still in control of David's life. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. We know that that's true today. We know that the one who indwells us is greater than the one who is in the world. You know, you're hearing so much these days about UFOs. Constantly. And I'm talking about mainstream news media now. Constantly. I want you to understand that, and I'm hearing all kinds of weird doctrinal teaching even on this from Christians. You know, that these are the Nephilim, and if you study that in the Old Testament, Genesis 6, you study it in the New Testament, that's not what Scripture says, okay? To me, it's very plain. 2 Peter is very plain on that. Jude is very plain on this, on who they are. That's got nothing to do with the price of beans. These are fallen angels. We do know that Satan took with him a bunch of fallen angels. We also know that angels are very powerful beings. And they can do things. They can appear in different ways. Strange things can happen. We see these things that violate the laws of physics. Some of these UFOs violate the laws of physics. We have people talking to them. Don't you find that odd? Oh, I communicate with them. You're communicating with a demon, my friend. Strange stuff. You know, I really think Satan probably knows he doesn't have much time left. It's interesting to consider what might be, and I don't know. I've been saying this for years, honestly. I remember saying this when I pastored in Detroit, that I think one of the great, and it's become even more so, I think one of the great lies that is going to be told after the rapture is the aliens came and got them. How credible do you think that's going to be now? Very credible. I mean, we look at it 10 years ago, we roll our eyes, that's really stupid. No one's going to believe that. Do you think no one's going to believe it now? That millions are missing? It's interesting when you hear people, too, that these quote-unquote aliens, demons, they don't like Christians. Well, imagine that. I wonder why that would be. Seems rather obvious, doesn't it? But here we have an individual who was under the influence of a demon. God is allowing this. Again, it's not out of control. All this stuff we see in the world today, it's not out of control. God's still in control. Keep that in mind. God was still in control in this situation in spite of a demon having his way with Saul. It was the judgment on Saul, but yet God said, "No further. You will not harm my servant David. I've got a plan for him." Oh, Satan wanted to harm him. You see, because from this man the Messiah would come. But God is in control. God allowed this in David's life, but didn't allow Saul to kill him. Does God ever allow things in our life that seem very strange. You know, all of this was preparing David for what God had called David to as the king of Israel. He needed maturity. How fast do you think David grew up? Everything that happened to him was something that would prepare him for the future. Even the fact that he was a shepherd, now he was going to shepherd God's people, Israel. Once again, shepherding prepared him. Every last thing. I remember my brother Jim, when his last days on earth, he was diagnosed first of all with MS. And then he had cancer as a result of some of the drugs that he was on for MS. And eventually he passed away in a nursing home. I remember him saying to me, "I'm so glad that God has managed my life and prepared me for this time." You know, God does that. He prepares us for times of trial. He prepares us for times of service. I think back on my early ministry, and I think of all the crazy stuff that happened to my wife and I through the years. I can tell you stories that will raise hairs in the back of your neck. It's just unbelievable, some of the things. Some of the situations, some of the stress. I remember working for a pastor early in my Christian life, who turned out to be a pervert. And then he proceeded to attack me. First church I pastored, he, you know, it was a problem, actually. I had another man that lied about me as well as an assistant. I had some crazy assistant jobs. I really did, ministries. You know what, though? It made me very conscious and very compassionate towards the assistants I had. And I determined I was going to treat them differently than the way I was treated. And I believe I did. Had some good assistants. You're going to see one of my former assistants during the IBFNA conference. He's actually one of the officers in the IBFNA. He's a really good man. He was my assistant for a number of years. I remember seeing him come into the church. He was unmarried at the time, ended up marrying his wife, and he's got grown children now and everything, and boy, I feel old, you know. God manages our lives and prepares us for what he calls us to. He has mine, and I'm glad he has. He prepared me to minister here and in the Middle East, with the gifts, the abilities, the things that he's taught me, the lessons he's taught me. God does that with us. He prepares us where he leads us. He prepares us for the situations that we're in. No, God doesn't bring something we can't handle. God brings things, allows things in our lives sometimes that we can't handle because we don't trust him, because we react incorrectly. But notice Romans chapter 8, verse 28. And you know, I've heard Christians say, you should never use this verse with another person. Oh, it's a terrible verse. Why would you say that? Listen. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. Oh, don't give me that verse. That's not what I need to hear. Then what do you need to hear? This is not good. This is not good news. God causes all things in our life, whether it's good, whether it's bad, yea, even the discipline in our lives. God causes all things to work together for good. Good meaning what? Enjoyable? No, not necessarily. But for our spiritual maturity and for his glory, shouldn't that be an encouragement to us? Well, this is happening for the glory of God. This is happening that I might be closer to Jesus. You see, the problem is many times our goal in life is not holiness, but happiness. If your goal is happiness, and somebody comes out and says, this is for the glory of God and it's for your good in the long run, we'll roll our eyes and say, shut up. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear this stuff. That's no comfort to me. It doesn't make me happy. Isn't that too bad? A lot of Christians are that way, though. I've heard it. I've heard this. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God. By the way, those who love God, I believe, includes every last believer. I think that terminology there refers to every believer. To those who are called, well, that would be believers, according to his purpose. This is what God does with Christians. And yes, even discipline, even the discipline of his children works together for their good. What is our desire for our children? When we discipline them as, man, I want to make their life miserable. I hope that's not it. Man, I hate my children. Is that what? I hope that's not it. I hope you're thinking, you know what? I want them to be more like Jesus. I want them to be good people that love God and serve him. Well, yes, that's why I discipline them. That's why, you know, I make them work so hard. That's why I bring some of these hardships into their lives. Because I want them to be good Christians. God does the same thing with his kids. Would he be any different? He allows certain things in our life to help us to be more like Jesus. Not everything is easy. Why? Because he wants us to serve him well. That we should rejoice in that. And so in all of this, when we see what's happened to David, it reminds us of Romans 8:28, because God brought some difficult things into David's life. But yet he was preparing David for service later on. Maybe you're going through some difficult things right now, but perhaps God is preparing you for something special that he has for you to do. Surely he is. He has something for every one of us to do, and he prepares us and manages our life very well. We just have to trust him with that management. Sometimes that's hard, I know. But we have to trust him. And when you're in the middle of a trial, in the middle of a problem, you know, when Saul's throwing the spear at you, you know, you're probably not thinking, praise God for this. But yet we need to understand in the long run, God is going to work this together for our good and his glory. Rest in that fact. Trust in him.